Good to have you tuned in. This is Dave Ross. Katrina Gichard in for Colleen. And Nick is in for Chris on traffic this morning. State Republican lawmakers are unveiling a package of more than three dozen bills to address what they say is a public safety crisis that has been ravaging communities across the state. Let's go live now to Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott. Hannah, good morning.
Good morning, Dave. Yes, this is a massive package that the state Republican lawmakers have dubbed Safe Washington, a Republican plan for increasing public safety, reducing crime, and putting victims first. It was announced yesterday during a midday press conference.
During the last legislative session, the majority party dropped the ball on public safety. They systematically remove some critical tools for law enforcement, reduce punishment for criminals, and missed opportunities to protect the public from repeat DUI offenders, and flat out surrendered on the war of drugs by, in effect, decriminalizing hard felony drug possession.
This Republican Senator Mike Patton, who contends that these policies have already had terrible consequences for communities in the state.
Violent crime is at a 25-year high. Murder is up 80%. Aggravated assaults are up. Rape is up. These policies, including some particularly bad anti-police legislation in the House, are making Washington a dangerous place. And this is verified by law enforcement throughout the state. And on top of that, it doesn't seem that they've got the message, because two House Democrats have introduced legislation to reduce the penalties for drive-by shootings at the same time that violent crime is soaring in Washington.
Republican Representative Gina Mosbrucker, she is the ranking Republican on the House Public Safety Committee. She says the GOP here is introducing a package of over 45 bills, with the goal of creating a safe Washington.
One, you'll see bills addressing the policing bills, the 1310 use of force, and also the 1054 police tactics bill that left the police, we would argue, handcuffed instead of the criminals. We have a package of bills addressing putting victims and survivors first and putting safety back in our communities. We have a package of bills Senator Wagner is going to talk about that has to do with fixing the Department of Correction problems that we've all seen throughout the news. We also have bills regarding property crime, which we would argue that are connected to State v. Blake, the court ruling that came down through the legislature last year, and we have fixes for that as well.
So Blake, just for anyone who's not familiar, is the decision from the state Supreme Court that undid our felony drug possession law, and then in the end ended up with the lawmakers passing a fix that essentially, according to Republicans, decriminalized most drug use for minor quantities. So that's what she's talking about there, some fixes and how that connects to property crimes, right? Because that can fuel that kind of thing. One of the things that they did at the bulk of this press conference was bring out Jill Brown. Her husband, Jeremy Brown, was a Clark County Sheriff Sergeant. He was on an operation last July when he was murdered.
Jeremy was murdered in the line of duty on July 23rd. He was ambushed in a parking lot while conducting surveillance. His assailants were known to law enforcement. There was reasonable suspicion that they were trafficking in stolen firearms, but there was not probable cause for arrest, which under these new laws is the threshold for use of force to include vehicular pursuit. While I cannot confirm that agencies involved were already responding within the parameters of these new laws, I can confirm that two pursuits of these individuals were called off in the days leading up to Jeremy's murder, one of them just hours before.
Now, she's not blaming the cops who called off those pursuits.
If the car had been pulled over, the guns would have likely been retrieved, and my husband would be with us today. Let me be clear that I don't place any blame on the agencies that were involved, but on the environment that has forced them to question how they can and should respond.
Now, she shared that her husband was already uncomfortable with the laws prior to his death.
Jeremy had many concerns with the public safety bills that had recently been passed, 1310 being at the top of his list. Knowing this and paired with the understanding that it could have played a role in our loss, I was immediately compelled to give him a voice because his was tragically and senselessly quieted in the course of his duty.
So that's basically what she did after his death. She started reaching out to her lawmakers and trying to
get
involved.
And can you clarify what the, so what is the current law on pursuits? As I understand, it's always been a rule that you do not pursue somebody if there is any danger you're going to kill an innocent person as part of your pursuit, right?
Right. Well, so there's a couple of different things. So there's a thing that happened outside our station yesterday where there was some question about the Seattle Police Department not engaging in a pursuit. And that has always been an SPD policy, predating any police reform laws that we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. There's other pursuits. It's fairly involved, but it's something that the law enforcement officers themselves, the threshold has changed as to when you should be in a pursuit, when you should engage. And it's fairly limited the way that the bill is written. But there's also some ambiguities. So it's one of the bills that you'll see even the Democrats who helped pass it fix in this upcoming session. It is the threshold for what is considered when you should go ahead and chase somebody is almost impossible to meet at this point. So
okay. So and also explain the other thing that you mentioned in passing, this this thing on not arresting people involved in drive-by shootings.
That yes, and I actually.
Tell me about that.
Breaking news on that, but I'll tell you what the setup was. So this was Representative Tara Simmons and Representative David Hackney who introduced this legislation. And what we have in this state is an aggravated murder statute. And there are 8 aggravating factors for a first-degree murder conviction that if any of those 8 factors are involved in the murder would mean an automatic life sentence, no chance for parole. One of those aggravating factors is drive-by shooting. So it has always led to mandatory life, no parole.
Mm-hmm.
This bill would undo that. It would make it just 7 aggravators that would left on that statute and remove drive-by shooting because the argument was that this is a law and the drive-by shooting was added because of the 90s gang and things that were going on. We were seeing so many drive-by shootings and the sponsors of this bill said this is an example of systemic racism and because it was targeted towards black people. I can tell you from people that I've talked to, including people in the black community who were outraged by this bill, that is not necessarily the
popular because some of those a lot of those drive-by shootings targeted black people. So if you're not going to punish the people who are targeting black people, I mean, how does that make anybody feel safer?
Yes. So the breaking news that I have on this is that I got a chance to speak to the House Public Safety Chairman yesterday, the Democrat, Roger Goodman, who had this to say when I asked him about what, you know, if it's going to pass, it has to go through his committee. And I said, what are you going to do about this bill?
Drive-by shooting is one of the 8 different possibilities for a conviction of aggravated murder. And so there may be a need to take a critical look at the aggravated murder statute in general. And yet this particular proposal comes at a time when we're already looking at broad sentencing reform. This is, needless to say, a very controversial proposal. I don't have time for it this session. I am not going to hold a hearing on it. And so the proposal is basically dead on arrival.
So it will not pass. It is not going to get a hearing and therefore will not move.
Okay. And one other loose end here. I saw that video that was posted. I guess Diane took it out the window of our studio on East Lake of this car, which decided just to drive down the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
And the police did not go after the driver. Is that what happened?
Right. Again, that is an existing SPD policy where they have had. It has nothing to do with our state's police laws. It has to do with the internal SPD policy where they just don't engage in pursuits. And I can't remember how long it's been in place, but it's just not something that they do.
Was anybody hit?
Not to my knowledge. And I will just to clarify, I was not there and I did not cover that story yesterday, but I am familiar with it. No, I don't believe so. I think, though, the policy allows for in certain cases when there could be a, you know, imminent threat to the life of someone, you know, public safety, that kind of thing, that it allows for you to take part in that pursuit in such a case.
I assume somebody at least got the license numbers. They, the long arm of the law can reach out and perhaps suggest that they not drive on the sidewalk anymore, right?
Well, but that was more than that. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that this was a person that was pulled over who had was in a stolen car. And I believe that they took off because of that reason. And then the officers did not chase down the sidewalk.
All right. Hannah Scott. Thanks, Hannah.
You bet.
Today's Daily Dose of Kindness is brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. In a time when this nation can seem so divided, two people from two different parts of the country show us there's far more that unites us. CBS's Janet Shamlian has the story.
Alabama's Tuskegee News has never had a journalist like Amy Miller. For one thing, Amy lives more than 1,000 miles from Tuskegee.
Hey, guy, how you doing? Hey.
And journalist Guy Trammell, with whom she shares a twice-monthly column.
When you're sharing the stories, you're actually getting to know each other.
I had this idea anyway about doing a column from a white perspective and trying to match it with somebody doing it from a black perspective.
Color Us Connected also runs in the newspaper covering Amy's community, South Berwick, Maine. Her idea, after the mostly white New England town became sister cities with the predominantly black southern city. Tuskegee welcomed South Berwick residents to visit as part of the exchange. Hospitality returned in Maine.
What has this relationship meant to you?
This is one opportunity to actually bring people together instead of a divided states, we're the United States.
There's no politics in the columns. Guy and Amy simply share a slice of life from their perspective. A black man in the South, a white woman in the North.
So now we feel like we're walking together towards the progress we want to make in this country.
Once you move from communication to relationships, something real can take place, and that's what's happened here.
Two communities finding common ground. Janet Shamlian, CBS News, Tuskegee, Alabama.
7:47, Seattle's Morning News, and joining us now from G. Ursula's show, G. Scott. I can't remember, except maybe when President Gerald Ford, after Nixon resigned, had that line in his speech, "Our long national nightmare is over." Except for that, I can't remember a president going after his predecessor the way Biden went after Trump in that speech, G.
He didn't stutter.
Well, he did make one mistake. He said 150 Americans voted, blah, blah, blah. He meant 150 million. But
right. That was yeah, I was shocked by that. I wasn't prepared or ready for it. I think the worst part about it is that President Biden didn't even call him by name, and he made sure to call him a defeated former president. He made sure to call him failed. He made sure to mention the loser. Like, I think that he knows that the way that he did that is going to, I mean, we're going to be seeing a statement here pretty soon.
Well, we already have. From Trump, you mean?
It's already come out?
Yep. He said, I'll read it if you want me to.
Yes.
Biden is working hard to try and deflect the incompetent job he is doing and has done on the horrible Afghanistan withdrawal, parenthesis, surrender, the borders, COVID, inflation, loss of energy independence, and much more. Everything he touches turns to failure. That's what you get when you have a rigged election.
Oh, so we're still on the rigged election.
We're still on the rigged election.
Yeah.
Are you saying you thought Biden was too rude in his speech?
No, he wasn't too rude, right? I mean, this is what we expect. I mean, I think that's the problem that we've just, a lot of times we skate around the truth, like, and that's the truth. The truth is we're still talking about a rigged election. The truth is that people across this country have used their platforms to encourage this type of talk, right? So when they say things like the election was stolen, when they do those things, yeah, you really put in the minds of others. Or when you try to say that, you know, the borders, I mean there's issues at the border, but let's be real, domestic violence extremism here in this country is it's the greatest threat in our country. What we see here and what we saw a year ago was unreal. Like, it's something that I could not believe that we were watching on TV live. Now, You know, one of the things that I think after a year of being there and seeing it all, I say this. Former President Trump is 100% responsible for what happened at the nation's capital. It shouldn't have happened, and it happened because of him. I also believe that not everyone there were there to create violence. And what I mean by that is this. I believe that 100% of people there were there as Trump supporters. But I was watching a clip of this one man, and he had on his mega hat, and he was a Trump supporter. But he goes over to the Capitol Police, and he's like, "Hey, call for backup. Do you see what's happening right here? There's violence here on our nation's capital. You can't let this happen." And the reason why I'm bringing that up is I'm saying this. I have been in situations in my life where I showed up for something and I got there and I'm like, I didn't sign up for this. Yeah. And I do believe that there are people that were there that probably turned around. I mean, you know, but it's unfortunate at the end of the day, one man is responsible for it all. And that one man still needs to be held responsible for that day.
To me, the unforgivable part of this is what it did to our image in the world. And I feel this viscerally because I visited the old Soviet Union. It was the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. I've been to China a couple of times. Been to places and met people who have truly lived under repressive regimes. I mean, you go to a country and you want to interview a person about, you know, what is it like to live here in the Soviet Union? And the answer you get back through a third party is, "I'm sorry, I cannot talk. I'm too young to die." And you realize that there's repression is real. And we fed those regimes by this. This is their goal, to demonstrate that here. This is what Putin wants. This is why you need me, Russia. You need me, Russia, because if we become a true democracy where the elections are real and you have a real choice, what you saw in America on January 6th is what you get. And the same with Xi Jinping. This is what they tell their people. And so that's the unpardonable part. It was like snuffing out the torch of the Statue of Liberty. I don't see any forgiveness for that. Unfortunately, there's still too many people, I feel, who buy into it, to think that was legitimate. That's the way you... And that's the antithesis of politics. That's violence. That's
because
tin pot dictatorship.
Well, at the end of the day, what's on the other end of continuing this conversation? It's 100% one of the biggest grifts ever, right? There's still money and there's fundraising efforts in that, right? And there's so many people that just don't see it. Right. They don't see the other side of misinformation being nothing but a money grab, nothing but a huge grift, nothing but to sit here and continue on with the election was rigged. Like, I mean, I truly believe this, Dave. Mm-hmm. I believe that the people that use their platforms to say things like the election being rigged or to empower those to believe that, I believe that the majority of them don't even believe that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It reminds me of a drug dealer selling drugs. I'm going to simplify this. That drug dealer knows that the drugs are bad that he or she sells.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter because they're making money off of the bad drugs that they are selling. This misinformation stuff is no different than the drug dealer.
Yeah.
Here's this bad stuff for you, but as long as you guys take it, I'm going to continue making money.
So you're saying it's not worth destroying the American experiment to sell more MyPillows? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'll end with this. I'm saying that there are people in this country that make money above that drug dealer and sit back and they know it's wrong and still don't say anything and allow that drug dealer to still sell those drugs because they make money too.
G joins Ursula at 9 o'clock here on Cairo Radio. Thank you, G.
Hey, oh,
choke points.
Let's go.
Brought to you by Primary Residential Mortgage. Chris is out today, but before he left, he and I spoke with Henry Grabar, who is a staff writer for Slate.com, and his article is headlined, "The American Addiction to Speeding." And he has documented what all of us have suspected, that the speeding law is among the most broken or ignored laws in America. And he did a ride along with a Connecticut state trooper at one point.
One of the most interesting things we did was he let me use his radar gun as we watched the cars come around the bend. And I was using it and everybody was clocking in under the speed limit. And I was thinking, what am I doing wrong here? And of course, the answer was everybody was slowing down because there was a police car with sirens on top of it sitting on the side of the road. But what's interesting is as you watch them come around the bend, you actually watch the front of the car dip. Because every car is slowing down. And the policeman who I was with, the trooper, called that dropping the anchor. And it's something that, the entire highway just slows down when they pass this officer. But of course, not for very long.
What's the problem that you hear that you want to address? Because I know the latest statistics in Washington State were terrible. We had a record year for accidents with injuries, a record year for fatalities as well, something like over 2,000. And a lot of it, a decent percentage anyway, is caused by speeding. So what works in terms of getting people to at least get close to the speed limit?
It not only is speeding a particularly deadly thing on the road, but fatalities on the road are rising really rapidly. They're saying traffic fatalities in 2021 went up during the first 6 months by 18%, which is the largest increase since DOT started counting. I think what's interesting about speeding, and it separates it from, let's say, drunk driving or distracted driving or some of these other problems that happen on highways, is that it's really easy to stop speeding if we wanted to.
Like photographs? I mean, we're already equipped to take pictures of every car that passes under a toll gantry, right? And we have sensors in the road that can sense how fast they're going. So if you wanted to photo find everybody who speeded, you could do that conceivably.
Yeah, I think that's something that other countries are doing, right? Like, I understand that people get really wary of that. And I think that's in part because some of the early camera programs we've seen have been operated as revenue generators rather than in the interests of public safety. But just because some programs are run badly doesn't mean that the idea itself is worthless. I think that the system we have now, where a policeman approaches you at 95 miles an hour with their lights flashing on the hood, that is not a good system by any objective metric. It does not slow drivers down. It is the source of 1 in 3 American interactions with police. It has totally revised our understanding of what the Fourth Amendment means. I mean, it's the source of many police shootings. There's just nothing good about that system, to say nothing of the fact that it's, I think, more invasive actually than a camera taking a photo of your license plate if you're going 95 miles an hour.
Henry, full disclosure, my son has started going to school in Montana, and I've been making a lot of drives across I-90, and there is something quite liberating about setting the cruise control at 90 on a wide open, flat, dry surface. So I will put that out there. Let me ask you a privacy issue related to all of this information is already contained and recorded in our cars. Anyway, why not use the data port, and what kind of issues might that get from, say, your car will eventually send you a ticket based on where you were and the speed limit in the places where you were driving?
That's a great question. I think that as autonomous driving technology becomes more common, you're going to see more confrontations over this subject as it becomes more and more clear that all this data is out there and potentially could be accessed, especially in the case, like, I'm not saying that we need to start arresting everybody who's going 3 or 4 miles over the speed limit. I think driving 90 in Montana is probably fine. But at the same time, there are clearly places where lots of people are speeding and they're doing extreme speeding, which is to say 30, 40 miles an hour above the limit. And it's causing death, not just deaths and accidents to drivers, but also to people who are just walking on the side of the road. So, you know, if you don't see the government try and do something about it, you might see car insurance companies start to get into it. It could be some sort of incentive. I think this already exists, actually, that you can get some sort of car insurance discount, right, for having a sort of tracker, keeping track of your driving habits.
Henry, and one thing you had mentioned also is, you know, the neighborhood streets where we see a lot more pedestrian versus car interactions, say in a downtown core or maybe through neighborhoods. What kind of impact do you see of some of the new technology we have? Like, for instance, I use Waze or another traffic app, and I'm then now forced into a neighborhood that I am completely unaware of and probably not watching my speed like I should. How much do you think that has kind of changed the interaction with being unfamiliar with your actual surroundings?
That's an interesting question. There was a time when traffic engineers were very conscious about routing traffic down the busiest streets and through poorer neighborhoods, through industrial neighborhoods, and so on, right? And so even if this wasn't necessarily the best route through the system, it was the route the engineers wanted you to take. And Waze has undermined all that and sort of blown up that whole system. And you now routinely hear about conflicts in residential neighborhoods where computer software has figured out that there's this great shortcut. And then all of a sudden, all these people who never really thought about what it might be like to live in a neighborhood where everybody was on their way to the highway, suddenly they have that experience. And they see cars going by 45 miles an hour when their kids are playing in the front yard. And I think that the awareness that that brings to people about this being a bigger issue is potentially a force for political change.
So do we see any changes like this being tried by any American states anywhere?
One program that I do want to draw your listeners' attention to is New York City's speed camera program. It's designed by the Department of Transportation, and it's designed for safety and not for revenue. And so what they do is they only fine you if you're going more than 10 miles over the speed limit outside a school that's in session. And the fines are relatively small. I think they're on the order of $45 or $50. And so what you have then is a fine that it's much more effective at catching people than a policeman sitting on the side of the road, obviously. And because it's more effective, the fines can be lower. And I think that's a really productive change, right? Instead of a $300 speeding ticket for going 90 on the highway, you're getting these small warnings that you need to change your behavior. And in fact, it works. You see, most drivers get one ticket and they don't get another. And at the same time, drivers who get multiple tickets, let's say 12 a week, which is not an unheard of occurrence, we begin to see who are the real dangerous drivers on the road. And then when it comes to speeding enforcement, we can focus a little more.
Henry Grabar from Slate.com. His piece is called The American Addiction to Speeding. Before I get to your full real-time traffic report here this morning, BMW, have you heard this, has come up with a technology that could allow you to change the color of your car with the flick of a button. Here's WWJ's auto reporter, Jeff Gilbert.
It's the same technology that lets you read books on a Kindle, just on a much larger scale. BMW engineers have put the e-ink onto a concept car. It changes from black to white in various combinations, no other colors, and it is a demonstration now that may or may not someday go into a production vehicle.
So how about that? I still think the Kindle's an amazing thing. I know it gets criticized, but works in natural light. Those little, tiny, little rotating globes that basically are like a slate, like paper. Except I know, I just know this is going to be used by the wrong people to disappear after doing something bad. 8:34, Seattle's Morning News. It's hard to believe we are still learning new information about the CHOP protests over the murder of George Floyd, but we are. And it turns out that at the height of those protests, Seattle police used a ruse to spread bogus information about a group of Proud Boys looking for a confrontation. The Office of Police Accountability has now decided that that ruse was a violation of policies. Let's go live to Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. So what happened here, Hannah?
So this is way back at the beginning, on June 8th, 2020. That was the day that the East Precinct was abandoned. That was also the beginning of the formation of the CHOP. And Amari Salisbury over at Converge Media, he was there in the zone when this was going on, and he remembered hearing about it. So that's eventually, he had a lot to do with why this was ever even investigated. At the same time, if you recall, if I wasn't down there in person, I would monitor their various protest communications channels. And I had seen back then information about the Proud Boys being on their way, right, to the protest mm-hmm. zone, armed, something like that. And I remembered this. So Amari and I got to talking about it one day, and this investigation was in the works for a long time, and it finally just came out yesterday. Here is some of the audio of this ruse and why it became a problem.
Small group, possible Proud Boys. It looks like a few of them might be open carrying.
So you hear there, he's saying that the Proud Boys are en route, maybe open carrying. Eventually, you hear more chatter about there's 20 to 30 in the group. They are looking for confrontation, headed towards Capitol Hill. And that's when you saw some of the people at the protest zone put up barricades, and some who were maybe were going to be armed anyway, but also more arms. There was a guy handing out guns. There was a lot of things that made it a volatile situation, even more volatile, which is why the Office of Police Accountability, one of the reasons why they found that this was such a problem and a violation. But also there was chaos. This is not something that everyone within the department, including the chief of police, even knew was going on. So Amari, this is how it all started. Amari had heard from another person who was one of our streamers who was out there with the protesters all the time, who had some audio and shared it to him. And then Amari tried to look for some confirmation. So basically, here's how it went down.
Crazy enough, in researching another story, this was in November of last year, I came across some footage that we had shot where protesters are saying, hey, the Proud Boys are on the way. And I remember that at the time, there was a lot of talk about, man, this was a hoax. People were saying that it was a hoax. And I reached out to Speck, who actually had a recording as well of the actual chatter at the time.
So then Amari went to OPA trying to get a confirmation. He wanted the body camera footage of any officers, because if they're engaged with somebody who is armed, they have to turn on their body worn cameras. And he thought that would be confirmation, because he's just not going to take the streamer's word for what this chatter was.
I just reached out to OPA saying, hey, can you match up the body cameras with this audio? And the other thing I'll put out there is a lot of people were looking for this audio. They were putting in like Freedom of Information Acts and PRs looking for the recording, and no one could find the recording. And so that's where people's investigation around what occurred kind of died, because, you know, it was coming back saying, hey, there's nothing here. There is no recording, which there wasn't any saved recording within SPD.
Not only was there no saved recording, there was no documentation, there was no after action report, there was no anything. This was a chaotic operation that involved six officers, basically, including at the time someone who was a captain and later became an assistant chief.
And so explain what their motivation was in making up this chatter on the police radio that the Proud Boys were coming.
They said in their OPA interviews, the commander, so you had a single person in charge, that's captain at the time, who said they had learned that the protesters were monitoring SPD communications. So they were trying to do a misinformation campaign to essentially split up the group. Because here's the scene at this point. All of the backup that SPD had, you know, your State Patrol, National Guard, any of those agencies, they're gone. They're not there anymore, because things had become so chaotic and the precinct had been abandoned. They're out. They're not there. So it's SPD on its own. There is a chaotic upper management situation going on where there's commanders who are doing something over here and somebody else is doing something over here. So this is a single operation with this handful. And the guy says over and over again, the captain to OPA, that he is trying to split the groups to kind of make it easier for the SPD to avoid being ambushed, assaulted, that kind of thing. So that's the idea. So you'll hear there's conversations on this audio about they're down over at City Hall. So their hope there would be that.
So then they were hoping that the demonstrators would be monitoring that chatter, and they say, oh, the Proud Boys are coming, we need to go and get them, and they would split off and go there.
And I can tell you that's exactly what happened. The protest chatter that I was monitoring at the time was all about that. They were like, this is what's going on here, and we've got the Proud Boys coming up, and people were puffed up, right? They were ready for a fight. Fortunately, that never happened. There were no Proud Boys.
Well, then let me ask you this. I mean, I know it's probably bad to make up stuff, but did it end up helping out the police and protecting them?
No. It didn't escalate things, but it definitely didn't do anything to help and split the group. In the end, you've got two findings of violation of policy for this captain who has since left the department, and then another number two who has also since left the department. The four actual just street cops who were there and who were called into this, they didn't get any kind of finding of being against policy, because they were just following their orders. There was no plan here. There was no, these lower cops had never done an operation like this before. There were no parameters or guidance or anything like that. So that's really one of the big issues here. The other big issue is that this really hurts community trust. It took 14 months for this to come out. And this investigation was completed in September of last year, and for whatever reason was only just released yesterday after much pressure from Amari that involved going all the way to the new mayor, Bruce Harrell. Bruce Harrell says to the Seattle Times, by the way, that this is not something that is allowable. To be clear, it is okay under state law for a misinformation campaign or a ruse to be used, but only in very specific circumstances. Those circumstances and being imminent threat to life, if you're an undercover cop, or if you have to do it in a very specific way to kind of prove your case, if you will. Yeah. But not in this situation where it could make an already volatile situation even more volatile.
And Cairo Radio's.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I got to wrap it up.
I know.
but we'll talk more about this, won't we?
you bet.
Yep. Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. You can ring my bell.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, has now taken it to the next level, and they no longer think the word pet is appropriate when referring to your, I guess we'd have to say, animal companions. Here's Rachel Bell.
Animal roommates.
What do they want us to call our furry friends?
Oh, yeah. Let's see. They want you to call them human carers.
Human carers. So in other words,
right off the tongue.
So they will now be defined in terms of their relationship with you. That seems kind of condescending.
That kind of seems like what it is. Yeah. I mean, I honestly had to check and make sure this wasn't an Onion article because I thought this can't be real. I mean, PETA, they do push it pretty hard in all different directions. So this comes from Ingrid Newkirk. She's the president of PETA. And she said, calling your pet a pet is derogatory and suggests they are merely a commodity or a decoration. She compared calling animals as pets to treating women the way that we were treated before feminism, and like as if, you know, women used to be property, calling women sweetie or honey. So she said, quote, animals are not pets. They are not your cheap burglar alarm or something which allows you to go for a walk. What? They are not ours as decorations or toys. They are living beings. Obviously, this is ridiculous, mostly because animals don't speak English and they don't know what you're calling them. Like, I understand that words have meaning. Like, people can say it's just a word, and yes, words do matter, but people generally love their pets and treat them as members of a family. And I think calling them a pet doesn't, you know, really influence the way that they are treating their animal.
Well, your cat knows, though. The cat knows everything. The dogs, I'm not so sure. The pets, most pets, seems to me, get a pretty good deal. I don't have a pet, but my daughter and son-in-law have a pet. And Cody's been a great dog. He's a, let's see, German Shepherd Husky mix. Never barks. Very good with the grandchild. And in exchange, he gets a beautiful 4-bedroom house and a warm place by the space heater. And, you know, all the food he wants, and gets to go on walks in a nice working class neighborhood. It's not a bad life, right?
I think that, you know, if you wanted to pick on something and really get existential, like I did and had a freak out moment after I adopted my cat 8 years ago, you could say, oh, maybe we shouldn't have domesticated animals. But we have, and we domesticated them to live the way they're living. And so that's kind of just how it is. And we've decided that it's okay to put a dog on a leash and have a cat poop in a box and keep them inside of our houses.
Is that what PETA's complaining about, that we domesticate it? Because we have also, let's keep in mind, we've domesticated ourselves as well. Okay. We don't poop in the forest anymore either. So I
think for yourself.
Sorry. You're right. I should have understood you have an alternative lifestyle. But you get what I'm saying here? We've all domesticated ourselves over the years.
I did have a little existential crisis when I brought my cat home from the shelter, because she used to be an indoor cat. And I left for the first time and I thought, oh, I get to leave. I can go anywhere I want. I can speak to everybody here. but she's alone and she doesn't have anyone to talk to because we speak different languages. Oh my mm-hmm. God, why did we do this? And I mean, you know, I
get a second cat.
Yeah, maybe. Well, she hates all cats. I do see the way that some people are with their dogs, and I don't agree with the way that they, you know, heavily discipline them. I feel bad sometimes for how good dogs have to be. They don't really get to be animals. But all of that aside, I don't think it really matters what we call them.
Yeah. Teach your cat to play solitaire on a smartphone. That's what I do, and I have nothing else to do.
Oh, gosh. I have, like, a few friends when they leave town and I've gone and fed their pets. They, you know, like, leave music on for them. I have a couple friends, they leave NPR on for their cats.
Absolutely.
And I'm like, I don't think your cat needs that. Your cat doesn't need to hear the soothing tones of NPR while you're gone.
I think cats love the Sunday puzzle.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yes.
The Sunday puzzle, I believe it's called.
That's pretty bad.
Sorry.
Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.